the wife of Bath's tale. In the old days of King Arthur, of whom Britons speak with great honor, all of the land was full of fairy creatures. The elf queen with her beautiful companions danced very often in many a green meadow. This was the old belief, as I read, I speak of many hundreds of years ago. But now man can no longer see the elves anymore because of the great charity and prayers of the licensed bakers and other holy friars. They search every land, every stream, as thick as specks of dust in the sunbeam, blessing halls, chambers, kitchens, bedrooms, cities, towns, castles, high towers, villages, barns, cattle sheds, and dairies. This makes it so there have been no fairies, for where an elf used to walk, there now walks the licensed beggar himself. At noontime and morning, he says his morning prayers and his holy prayers as he goes on his begging rounds. Women may go safely up and down, for in every bush or under every tree, there is no other incubus but he, and he will not do them any harm but dishonor. And so it happened that King Arthur had in his house a lively young knight, who one day came riding from hawking. It happened that, alone as he was born, he saw a maiden walking before him. And from that maiden, at once, in spite of all she could do, by great force he ravished her maidenhood. For which rape was such clamor and such demand for petition made unto King Arthur, that this knight was sentenced to death by course of law, and should have lost his head. Perhaps were such the rules then. But the queen and other ladies so long prayed the king for mercy until he granted them the knight's life, and gave him to the queen, all at her will, to choose whether she would save him or put him to death. The queen thanked the king with all her might, and after this she spoke to the knight, when she saw her time upon a day.
"You are alive yet," she said. "In such a situation, though your life has no assurance, I will grant you your life if you can tell me what thing it is that women most desire. Be wary and keep your neck bone from the blade. And if you cannot tell it immediately, I will give you leave to go for 12 months and a day to seek and learn a satisfactory answer in this matter. And I will have some security before you go, that you will deliver yourself in person in this place."
Woe was the knight, and sorrowfully he sighs. But what? He cannot do all as he pleases. And at last he chose to depart, and come again, right at the year's end, with such an answer as God would provide him. And he takes his leave and sets out. He searches every house and every place where he hopes to have good fortune, to learn what things women love most. But he could not arrive in any region where he might find in this matter two creatures agreeing with each other. Some said women love riches best. Some said honor. Some said gallantry. Some said finery. Some said pleasure in bed, and oftentimes to be widowed and wed. Some said that our hearts are most soothed when we have been flattered and pleased. He gets very near to the truth, I will not lie. A man shall win us best with flattery. And with attention and with attentiveness, we are snared, every one of us. And some say that we love best to be free, and to do right as it pleases us, and that no man reprove us for our vices, but say that we are wise, and not foolish at all. For truly, there is not one of us, if anyone rubs us on a sore spot, that we will not kick because he tells the truth. Try it, and he shall find it true. For, be we never so vicious within, we wish to be considered as wise and clean of sin. And some say we have great delight to be considered stable, and also discreet, and in one purpose steadfastly to dwell, and to not disclose things that men tell us. But that tale is not worth the rake handle. By God, we women can conceal nothing. Witness on Midas. Do you want to hear? Ovid, among other trivial things, said Midas had, under his long hair, growing upon his head, two ass's ears. The vice he hid with his best might, very cleverly from every man's sight. And that, save for his wife, nobody knew of. He loved her the most and trusted her also. He prayed her that no creature she should tell of his disfigurement. She swore to him.
Nay.
Even to gain the whole world, she would not do that wickedness or sin, or to make her husband have so foul a reputation. She would not do it, for fear of her own shame. But, nevertheless, she thought she would die if she should hide a secret so long. She thought it swelled so painfully about her heart that necessarily some words would have to slip from her, and since she dared not tell it to any man, down to a marsh fast she ran. Until she came there, her heart was on fire, and as a bittern booms in the mire, she laid her mouth down unto the water.
"Betray me not, water, with your sound," she said. "To you, I tell it, and nobody else. My husband has two long ass's ears. Now my heart is healed. Now it is out. I could no longer keep it out of doubt."
Here, you may see, though we a time wait, yet it must come out. We can hide no secret, the remnant of the tale. If you will hear, read Ovid, and there you may learn about it. This knight, about whom my tale is in particular, when he saw that he might not discover it, this is to say, what women love most, within his very breast sorrowful was the spirit. But home he goes. He could not stay. The day came that homeward he must turn, and in his way he chanced to ride, in all his sorrow, by a forest side, where he saw a dance go of ladies 24, and yet more. Towards that dance he went eagerly, in the hope that some wisdom he should learn. But certainly, before he came fully there, this dance vanished, but he did not know where. No creature he saw bore life, except that on the green he saw sitting a woman, a foul creature that no man could imagine. This old woman stood up to meet the knight and said,
"Sir knight, in this direction lies no way out. Tell me what you seek, by your faith. Perhaps it may be the better. These old folk know many things," she said.
"My dear mother," said this knight, "certainly I am dead unless I can say what thing it is that women most desire. If you could give me guidance, I would repay you handsomely."
"Pledge me your faith here in my hand," she said. "The next thing that I ask of you, you shall do it if it lies in your power, and I will tell it to you before it is night."
"You have my word," said the knight. "I agree."
"Then," she said, "I dare boast your life is saved, for I'll make it good. Upon my life, the queen will say as I. Let us see which is the proudest of them all who wears a headcloth or a hairnet, who dares contradict what I shall teach you. Let us go forth without longer speech."
Then she whispered a message in his ear and bid him to be glad and have no fear. When they came to the court, this knight said he had kept his day as he had promised, and his answer was ready, as he said. Very many a noble wife, and many a maid, and many a widow, for they are wise, and the queen herself, sitting as judge, assembled to hear his answer, and afterwards this knight was ordered to appear. To every person silence was commanded, and that the knight should tell in front of the audience what thing it was that women love best. This knight did not stand silent as a beast, but to his question he answered immediately with a manly voice, so that all the court heard it.
"My liege lady, without exception," he said, "women desire to have mastery as well over her husband as her lover, and to be in dominance over him. This is your greatest desire, though you kill me. Do as you wish, I am here at your will."
In all of the court, there was no wife, nor maid, nor widow that denied what he said, but said that he was worthy to have his life. And with that word, up jumped the old woman, whom the knight saw sitting in the meadow.
"Mercy," she said, "my sovereign lady queen, before your court breaks up, do me justice. I taught this answer to the knight, for which he pledged me his truth there. The first thing that I would ask of him, he would do it, if it was within his might. Before the court, then I pray to you, sir knight," she said, "that you will take me as your wife, for you know well that I have saved your life. If I say false, say nay upon your faith."
This knight answered, "Alas, and woe is me. I know very well that such was my promise. For God's love, choose a new request. Take all my property and let my body go."
Nay, then, she said, I curse us both, for though I am ugly and old and poor, I would not wish, for all the metal nor ore that is buried under earth or lies above, anything other than to be your wife and also your love.
My love, he said, nay, my ruin. Alas, that any of my family should ever be so fully disgraced by a misalliance.
But all for nothing. This is the end that he was constrained to. He must wed her out of necessity, and he takes his old wife and goes to bed. Now some men would say, perhaps, that for my negligence I take no pains to tell you the joy and all the splendor that was at the wedding feast that day, to which I shall shortly answer, I say, there was no joy nor feast at all. There was nothing but gloom and much sorrow, for he wedded her in private the next morning. And all day after, he hid like an owl. So woe was he. His wife looked so ugly. Great was the woe that the knight had in his thoughts. When he was in bed with his wife, he thrashes about and turns to and fro. His old wife lay smiling all the time and said,
Oh, dear husband, bless me. Is this how every knight acts with his wife? Is this the law of King Arthur's house? Is every knight of his this hard to please? I'm your own love and also your wife. I am she who has saved your life, certainly, and I have never done you wrong. Why do you behave like this with me this first night? You behave like a man who has lost his wit. What is my transgression? For God's love, tell it, and it shall be amended if I can.
Amended, said this knight. Alas, nay, nay, it will not be amended ever. You are so ugly, and so old also, and additionally descended from so low a family, that little wonder it is that I toss and twist. Would to God that my heart would break.
Is this, she said, the cause of your unrest?
Yes, certainly, he said. It is not surprising.
Now, sir, she said, I could amend all this, if I wish, before 3 days, if you behave well towards me. But since you speak of such nobility as is descended out of old wealth, that therefore you should be noble men, such arrogance is not worth a hint. Look who is always the most virtuous, privately and in public, and always strives the most to do the noble deeds that he can. Take him for the greatest nobleman. Christ wishes for us to claim our nobility from him, not from our elders, from their old wealth. Though they gave us all their inheritance, for which we claim to be of high lineage, yet they cannot bequeath in any way to any of us their virtuous living, that made them be called noblemen, and bid us to follow them in such condition. Well can the wise poet of Florence, who is called Dante, speak in this maxim. Lo is such manner of rhyme as Dante's tale. Very seldom rises up from his small branches excellence of man, for God, of his goodness, wants us from him to claim our nobility. From our elders, we can claim nothing but temporal things, which may hurt and destroy man. Also, everyone knows this as well as I. If nobility were planted naturally into a certain lineage down the line, privately and in public, then, would they never cease to carry out the excellent practice of nobility? They could do no shameful action or vice. Take fire and bear in the darkest hours between this and the mount of the Caucasus, and let men shut the doors and go then. Yet will the fire finally blaze and burn, as if 20,000 men could behold it. It will still maintain its natural function, as I live until it dies. Here may you truly see how nobility is not linked to wealth, since folk do not perform their function in all circumstances, as does the fire, lo, according to its nature. For, God knows it, men may well often find a lord's son doing shame and villainy. And he who wants to be esteemed for his nobility, because he was born of a noble house, and had his noble and virtuous elders, and is unwilling himself to do any noble deeds, nor follow his noble ancestors that are dead, he is not noble, be he a duke or an earl, for base sinful deeds make a churl. For nobility is nothing but renown of your ancestors, for their high virtue, which is an external thing to your person. Your nobility comes from God alone. Then our true nobility comes from grace, is in no way bequeathed to us with our rank. Think how noble, as says Valerius, was that Tullus Hostilius, that out of poverty rose to high nobility. Read Seneca, and read also Boethius. There shall you see explicitly that it is no doubt that he is noble who does noble deeds. And therefore, dear husband, I conclude, although it was my ancestors who were uncultivated, yet may the high God, and so I hope, grant me grace to live virtuously. Then I am noble, when I begin to live virtuously and shun sin. And whereas you reproach me for poverty, the high God in whom we believe in voluntary poverty chose to live his life. And certainly, every man, maiden, or wife, may understand that Jesus, heavenly King, would not choose a vicious form of living. Glad poverty is an honorable thing, certainly. This will Seneca and other clerks say. Whoever considers himself satisfied with his poverty, I hold him rich, even if he did not have a shirt. He that covets is a poor person, for he would have that which is not in his power. But he that has nothing, nor covets anything, is rich, although you hold him as nothing but a commoner. True poverty, it sings characteristically. Juvenal says a poverty appositely. The poor man, when he goes by the way, before the thieves, he may sing and play. Poverty is a hateful good, and, as I guess, a very great release from anxiety, a great increaser also of wisdom to him that takes it in patience. Poverty is this, although it seems wretched, possession that no person will challenge. Poverty very often, when a man is low, makes him know God and himself. Poverty is a lens, I think, through which he may see his true friends. And therefore, sir, since I do you no harm, of my poverty you should reprove me no more. Now, sir, for old age you reprove me, and certainly, sir, though no written authority was in any book, you nobles of honor say that men should favor an old person, and call him father for your nobility. An author shall I find, as I guess. Now, where you say that I am ugly and old, then you should dread not of being a cuckold. For filth and old age, as I may prosper, are great guardians of chastity. But nonetheless, since I know your pleasure, I shall fulfill your worldly appetite. Choose now, she said, one of these two things, to have me ugly and old until I die, and to be a true and humble wife, and never displease you in all my life, or else you would have me young and fair, and accept the risk of the flocking of people that shall be at your house because of me, or in some other places it may well be. Now choose yourself which of the two that you like.
This knight reflects and sighs deeply, but at last he said in this manner, My lady and my love and wife so dear, I put myself in your wise control. Choose yourself that which may be most pleasant and most honored to you and me. I do not care between either of the two, as what you like, it will satisfy me.
Then I have one mastery over you, she said, since I may choose and govern as it pleases me.
Yes, certainly, wife, he said. I consider it best.
Kiss me, she said. We are no longer angry, for, by my truth, I will be to you both. That is to say, yes, both fair and good. I pray to God that I may die insane, unless I am as good and true to you as ever was wife, since that the world was new. And if I am not by tomorrow as fair to see as any lady, empress, or queen, that is between the east and also the west, do with my life and death as you please. Lift up the curtain, look at how it is.
And when the knight truly saw all of this, she was so fair and so young as well. For joy, he took her in his two arms. His heart bathed in a bath of bliss. 1,000 times in a row he gave her kisses, and she obeyed him in everything that might do him pleasure or liking. And thus they lived until their lives end in perfect joy. And Jesus Christ, send us husbands meek, young, and fresh in bed, and the grace to outlive them with whom we wed. And also I pray Jesus to shorten the lives that will not be governed by their wives, and old and angry misers in expenditure. God send them soon the very plague. Here ends the Wife of Bath's tale.